The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy. I'm director of author events, and I am pleased to welcome our guests this evening. If Allen Ginsberg and Emily Dickinson spawned across time to make a poetic love child, they might have created Patricia Lockwood. If you've read Miss Lockwood's work, you might have your own ideas about her literary progenitors, and perhaps we'll find those out later. But whomever they are or were, they and she have given us one of the most unique voices in contemporary poetry. In a recent review for the New York Times, the writer called Lockwood's new collection, Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland Sexuals, a book at once angrier and more fun, more attuned to our time, and more bizarre than most poetry can ever get. A book easy to recommend for people who do not read new poetry often, as well as for almost all the people who do. Well, that's just about everyone, including us. Please welcome Tricia Lockwood.
Guys, hi, you can move up to the front. Like, you can get so close to me. You can get insanely close. Okay. No, like, do it. Like, you can sit on the floor if you want. Like, it's one of those storytelling hours for kids. Because honestly, that is going to be what this is. I'm told that this lectern is, like, extremely strokeable. So I'm going to be doing some of that. Also, we are conducting an experiment where the first half of my reading, I will be under the influence of no substances whatsoever, but halfway through, I am going to be helicoptered in a Red Bull. I'm going to slam it up here without even pausing to take a breath. And then we're going to see if there's any difference. So I'm just telling you to look forward to that. Now, okay, so yes, this is my second time in Philly. Can I just ask you guys a question about what, like, I feel more sexually popular in Philadelphia than I've ever felt anywhere else in the world. Can you please tell me what's going on? I feel like I'm, like, ovulating out of my mouth as I walk down the street. I have no idea. Can anyone, like, tell me what's happening? Yes. Okay, yeah, but I mean, that's true. It's also true in the rest of America and Canada as well. So what is this special Philly thing? I had two dudes, separate dudes, yell, "Fresh cut!" at me across the street. And that's actually, I like that kind of compliment, because I'm like, yes, that is an aesthetic haircut compliment. That's what I want. Like, okay, yes, it is a fresh cut. Thank you. All right, so let's do this. I think that I will begin tonight by reading the most controversial thing I have ever published, my Grub Street diary for New York Magazine. I don't know why people got so pissed about this, but they did. Friday, August 22nd. Now breakfast. Breakfast is a fool's meal, and I would rather be poisoned than eat a single bite of breakfast. Everything about it is baby food, except for the vulgar American meats, which seem to have been carved straight off Paul Bunyan's own ass. Eggs are just a shape, and toast is the reason the British no longer rule the world, too cozy and complacent. I do drink a coffee, though. I'm not going to pretend the Enlightenment didn't happen. 12 p.m. I drink another coffee. Actually, I drink three more coffees. Am I supposed to be talking about all the coffee I'm drinking? That would take up too much space, I fear. Assume I drink so much coffee that sometimes I pretend that it's gas and I'm a little diesel truck that needs to get all the way across the country with my load. 2 p.m. I sit in my backyard eating a chicken sandwich and sighing tragically after every bite. This sandwich is as cold as the universe. Here's the thing. I don't need to be rich. I just need to make enough money so that I can sometimes eat at one of those places that makes your sandwich hot for you. I don't know why, but it seems so hard to make your sandwich hot at home, even though it should be easy. 8:30 p.m. I make it a habit to eat whatever's in the books I'm reading. This means chowder for Moby Dick, mixed grill for the corrections, mushrooms and sour cream for speak memory, and a hamburger with french fries for Ramona Quimby, age 8. It means that whenever I read Redwall, I go out into the yard and eat flowers. Be careful with this. There are Daturas in my yard, and if I accidentally eat one of these, I am told I will experience a vision quest in the manner of Ayla from the Clan of the Cave Bear books. Right now I'm reading the new Murakami, which means I eat pasta while listening to classical music and thinking about cats and wondering what it would be like to live down in a well. I bet I would love it. 12 a.m. Oh no. It's PMS. You know what this means. I have to eat an entire jar of capers one by one with a shrimp fork at midnight. Saturday, August 23rd, 2 p.m. Fine, I'll submit myself to the indignity of breakfast. I'll eat a yogurt. What is yogurt? Is the yogurt having sex in my mouth as I eat it? Is it some sort of dairy orgy? Maybe that's why the women in the commercials always make such sensual faces as they slide the spoon of demon curd in and out of their mouths. The yogurt claims to be Greek, but I don't know why. Perhaps a centaur drizzled honey over it with his tail. That would be Greek as hell. 7 p.m. Listen, I am writing a book. I don't have time for meals. And why haven't we reached a Jetsons point yet where everything we need is in capsules? I want to die. Oh, my husband Jason arrives home at the crucial psychological moment, rushes into my study, and drops a giant slice of fruit tart in my mouth before either of us can say a word. My death is averted for now. 9:30 p.m., I consider myself to be crunch punk, which means that if I don't hear my food crunching, I starve. I haven't crunched anything all day, so in order to keep myself mentally and physically hearty, I eat approximately 100 potato chips. 11 p.m. I sip a mug of kratom tea, which is a legal vitamin that makes music sound better to people. It also makes you very hungry. Under its influence, I wolf an enormous turkey sandwich while listening to Brain Salad Surgery and become one with the glittering cosmos. My mouth glistens with a galaxy of mayonnaise. Turkey is a dinosaur, I think, disoriented, and fall asleep dreaming of myself flying a turkey dactyl so close to the sun that it becomes perfectly roasted and embraces me with a pair of enormous brown drumsticks. Food is truly a miracle. Sunday, August 24th, 11:30 a.m. A handful of craisins, the clit of fruit. 3 p.m. I watch Tom Popo while eating ramen. Yes, I do eat ramen every day because I am a student of life. What is going on with that one scene where the guy puts a live prawn on a woman's bare stomach and lets it wiggle around until she climaxes? How do I figure out how to do that at home? 5:30 p.m. Time for a purse surprise. Purse surprise is where you open up your purse and just eat anything that's accumulated in it over the past few weeks. I get lucky this time. 5 beef sticks, 3 oranges, a box of mints, 2 coffee truffles, and a pill that could honestly be anything. 7 p.m. All I eat for dinner is the internet. It tastes awful. After midnight, gremlin time. I Google the words, can you be addicted to Snapple Mango Madness, and come upon a bunch of pregnant women talking about the new sinister hold that Snapple has on them. If it turned out I were pregnant and the only symptom I had was that I was suddenly addicted to Snapple and I wanted to drink 10 a day until a pure tropical baby fell out of me, this would be the best ad campaign Snapple ever had. I better get started. I drink a Snapple Mango Madness. Monday, August 25th. My husband has long dreamed of opening up a restaurant called Jason's Gross, where he only serves things that sound good to him, such as pizza with pepperoni and strawberries and mashed potato sundaes, which I don't even have the heart to inquire about. Today I tell him I will eat anything he makes. He rubs his hands together with glee and begins to write out a menu. Throughout the course of the day, he serves me raw banana in elegant slices, futuristic protein bar that resembles an astronaut BM, pretzels with ketchup, no one ever tries it, but it's good, and quinoa mound with pubic sprouts, erotic meal. Brava, I tell him, dabbing my lips with the linen napkin. Jason is, indeed, gross. Not wanting to hurt his feelings, I sneak into the kitchen at midnight and eat like an entire rotisserie chicken. Tuesday, August 26th. This diary would be a waste if I didn't get drunk at least once with my mom. We head out to an Italian restaurant in Kansas City and order artichoke and smoked mozzarella pizzas and a bottle of white wine. Jason isn't drinking wine right now because he is healthy, so my mom and I have the bottle all to ourselves. This is good until she drinks a second glass and decides to tell us the story of a man who just died in a tragic cliff-diving accident. He was so fun-loving, and it ultimately killed him, she says. The pizza falls out of my mouth. My fork clatters to the table. We exit the restaurant with tears in our eyes. To cheer us all up, I force us to go to the local Baskin-Robbins and order daiquiri ices. I haven't eaten one of these since high school, and it tastes much more synthetic than I remember. Jason's face, as he samples it, recalls one of those YouTube videos of a baby eating a lemon for the first time. He shudders. His expression passes through stages of betrayal, disgust, anger at God. It tastes like going down on a My Little Pony, he says finally. Does this contain corn syrup? My mother shrieks, because that makes me misbehave. And sure enough, before we know it, she has hurled her cone into the trash, raced out of the Baskin-Robbins, and jumped into her car. She's freaking out on corn, flooring it through every yellow light she passes, and telling us a story about how her father once ate 30 ears of corn in a cornfield and then threw up. It's why I can't tolerate corn, she yells at the top of her lungs. Soon enough, it becomes clear where we're going. To the Cheesecake Factory, the locus of her existence, to get some iced tea. The Cheesecake Factory is terrifying for several reasons. First, because factory implies the existence of a Willy Wonka running around in the bowels of the restaurant. This is big. He's wearing a giant hat in the shape of a genital lily. He's juggling balls of fried mac and cheese. He's experimenting with hideous new skinny-licious concoctions, and he's taking bad children on canal rides. Second, because why not call it what it is? Vagina hallucinations in Byzantium. I'm somehow hungry again, so I eat, it grieves me to report, a plate of desecrated chicken tendies that have been breaded with crushed pretzels. Why? Who had this idea? No one knows, but far off in the distance, I am sure I can hear Willy Wonka laughing. Is my Red Bull here? You guys, my Red Bull's here. Okay. All right. So, it's a big one. I'm going to drink it all, though. I'm not only going to drink half, I'm drinking every drop. It's got sugar in it, too. It's way worse than the regular kind that I get. All right, so let's do this. Holy crap. That is not a healthy drink. I did it. I think I can feel it already. What if I barfed? I'm not saying I will, but what if I did? All right. Now let's transition into the poetry. I'm getting there. Just letting my bull settle a little bit in the old tum. Is there anyone named Gary in this audience? If there is, I'm afraid that I'm going to have to ask you to leave. No, we're good. We're good on the Gary. All right, I have a reason for asking. Also, if I belch into the mic just like that, don't even act like it's rude. It's actually polite, and I'm going to do it again. The Hunt for a Newborn Gary. Once babies were born as Garys, and no one doubted what they were. And they were true men, these babies, with Dangle. And the very name Gary, it had the sound of exposing itself to you. Each Gary made a fine crowd noise. Each Gary was a crowd to cheer his death-defying loop-de-loops. And each Gary went wild when he did not die. One Gary after another in a loud, unbroken line. But was somewhere born a baby named Gary? Sometime in the last 15 years? Not one, says the living record. Not at 2 o'clock in the morning, not at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And Gary sounds to us now the way Orville must have sounded in 1950. A man in the brand new days of the car saying haw and gee to his Ford. He can't help it. So recent did the horse flank twitch beneath the fly. What Garys are still alive are gray. They ask to hold our newborns, and the rest of the family looks on afraid. If the infants are dropped and broken, they will make a sick, overripe sound. Gary. Now just 1 minute, I interrupt. My father had that name. I don't believe a word of this, except for the honest word Gary. When he had it, the name was in fullest flower, and perfectly a name of the now. And he shot wiggling seconds into my mom. And one of them plumped and grew big-headed. And he named me, he couldn't help it, Orange. And my life was a film as long as my life, of my name growing mold in real time. I was part of a picnic basket and packed for a family trip. For a family trip to where? The past. And Gary was a canyon there. And the babies of the past tumbled into him happily. And the sunset into him was famous. And up and down his sides grew the freshest, wildest 4 o'clocks. So is it different yet? Do you like, is my speech, am I getting like speedier? Just if at any point you notice that I'm starting to freak out on it, just like make a little note in your notebook and then let me know later, because this is a scientific experiment. Thank you. Let's do government spending. The government spent a Patricia on me. A huge waste, it lamented, when we could have been spending it on another Nixon. The government spent all its beauty on the great light leap on the deer crossing sign. There was hardly any beauty left for anything else in America. And looking around them, the government said, "Is there none left? Print more. You are born. You barely contain yourself. You grow. Inside you, someone spends $1 billion to make prison more luxurious. Inside you, someone spends $1 billion to keep libraries open 1 hour later. Then, oh God, you feel wonderful. You must be on welfare." The government spent its whole education on me. At least, that is how it feels right now, I am bursting with educational dollars. I am bursting with other dollars as well. I am rounded up. I'm one long row of O's. I get so many commas, the sentence doesn't stop. The dollars in me are a map of Missouri my mother can't fold back up. Oh no, the map is everywhere. But I know the way. I am hot on a trail. I am bursting with the dollars that put that knowing breath in drug dogs. All the spending of the space program is in me. The stars seem especially close. This is because they are a government handout. They are spending millions on moonlight research. When I am president, I will cut the arts and let my right arm flow downhill. I am ready. There is nothing trivial about me left. I am eliminating the penny every second. A dollar is peeled off a roll of thousands. It is the day. The mint of it is in my mouth. I open it, completely fresh. I think there's actually like a tiny bit left in here. I don't know if I got it all. Should I suck down the last drop? Suck it down. All right, round two. Round two. Does anyone know how to do a can crush? Is anyone good at those? I mean, I can't do them, but if someone wants to crush this can later, that would be awesome. I think that I will end with the father and mother of American tit pics. Obviously, I was thinking a lot about gender when I was writing this book. I was thinking about the concept of male and female bodies as forms that flesh is continually poured into. Like, we talk about bodies that way, but that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't feel true to me. So I was thinking instead about sexual characteristics or secondary sexual characteristics as instead being forms that can light anywhere on anyone and what that means. But it's funnier than that, too. So don't, it's not like douchey or anything. That's not the douchey gesture. That's a different one, but like, what is the douchey gesture? Wait, let's come up with one. Like this? I don't know what they do, honestly. It's like water. So, okay, so douchey. That's what we're going to do from now on. If anyone has any like better idea, honestly, just tell it to me later, because I don't think that one is very good. The father and mother of American tit pics. The father and mother of American poetry are back from the dead for just one day. They are standing up out of their graves, turning to each other, exchanging their tit pics, and then retreating back into the earth in their silence and the handfuls of dust all over them that were not their tits at all. Thank God they were able to do this, or we might never have known what the tits of them looked like. When you want to say a poet is mysterious, say, very few tit pics of him exist. Or, reading his letters and journals, we are able to piece together a pic of his tits. They loved butter and radishes and were devoted to his sister. Neither of the poets were transcendentalists, but their tit pics rose up and floated over all and filled up the sky with rose-colored clouds. I admit that I brought them back from the dead because I was standing in front of the mirror taking picture after picture of my tits in order to establish for once in all time what a tit actually looks like, since according to the dictionary, lots of things can be a tit, even including a bird and an idiot. I have birds and idiots all over my body, but not where my pecs are, I shouted. I was furious. Let me set down the meaning of the tit and get the last word on it. Commence me taking hundreds of boob photos and studying them closely and thinking most of these don't even look like boobs. They look like birds and idiots. And I thought, This is not something Emily Dickinson would have done. Or is it? Emily Dickinson was the father of American poetry, and Walt Whitman was the mother, suckling grizzled wild dogs at his teats. Walt Whitman nude in the forest, staring deep into a still pool, the only means of taking tit pics available at that time. Too many people fell in and drowned in that age before we learned to really swim in the tit pic. Raindrops fell into the still pool of the tit pic, rippling it outward and jiggling it, since the jiggle within the tit pic is what we're really after. The wild dogs, they grew up and grew tame, and learned to be owned by American poets, and take them for walks around lakes, as a poet isn't happy unless he's walking in a circle with the double meaning of the word tit just bouncing away on his chest. And meaning on the writing wobbling there, like Walt Whitman's tits on the lake. How beautiful, almost like a part of nature. Walt Whitman with a bra on his head, which is keeping his thoughts from being totally bare. The bra is too small, and the bra is made of lace, and his friends are saying, Walt, you are falling out, and wow, Walt, you are giving everyone a show, and why are you giving away the cow for free when I only wanted to hear the moo? The boys, when looking at Walt Whitman, would nudge each other and say, a body like that could never drown. Meaning, I guess, that his boobs would float him? Or that his lungs were really big, so there had to be a lot of breath in them? I never really understood that one. Or, when he was riding the ferry and leaning over to look at the glittering river, the boys would nudge each other and holler, careful not to tip over with those huge jugs, Walt. But wouldn't his huge jugs just scoop up the water till the river was dry? And then he would go walking home on the riverbed with his triumphant jugs balanced in front of him, threatening to spill but not spilling a drop, and even the glitter still intact in them? The gulf between a word and what it represents is still so great, but a shocking reflection of perfect tits floats and will always float there. What I am trying to say is that metaphors are dangerous. If teeth are like pearls, and if skin is like a pearl, and if the gates of heaven were 12 pearls, imagine the pearl explosion that would happen if someone bit their own boob in the afterlife. Which we have to assume Walt Whitman is doing to make St. Peter upset, which is not very mature. But I'll tell you what is mature, Walt Whitman's incredible boobs. I mean, he's had 200 years to develop them. Perhaps that's why breasts have gotten bigger, because American poetry is accumulating in our lungs and has to push its way out somehow. But back to how metaphors are dangerous. When he is old, his boobs will seem to him like raindrops trickling down and attempting to join a larger body of water. Thank goodness they're trickling down a window so all of us can see it happen. And we are a girl, and we're reading a book as the human rain pours relentlessly down. Emily Dickinson, for instance, the father of American poetry, is reading Shakespeare there just through the window. And her own body is so fierce and so hot that any droplets that landed there would instantly burn up. Emily has a beautiful black and white beard that reaches down to the ground, and lightning streaks zigzag out of her mouth. This is disputed by her photographs, but her photographs know nothing, and half of them aren't even her. The beard flows over her chest, and to look at it is literacy. Since the handwriting found in the beards of the past was so curling and flourishing and so feminine, everyone could read it. When she trims the beard, the trimmings fall onto the page and never move again except the dashes, which rearrange themselves in the night. We have thought two things about her. One, that she was a little woman prune, and two, that she was an almost mentally overripe plum that was bursting all over the place and calling the wasps to it. The general assumption has been that her tit pics would not be worth looking at if they existed at all, which is false, since I have secret information that they were actually four-dimensional and measured in minutes rather than cups, and wouldn't you like to get a load of those deep and boundless pools of time? Though maybe you think time doesn't exist, and that's where you got the idea that she was unblessed in the boob department. What I'm saying is that her boobs were so big they were practically geological ages, and the beard of Father Time flowed over them. The reason she always wore a white dress, for instance, is so that men would every minute be aware of the soft mounds of time shining through them. "Eyes up here, buddy," she would say, when their eyes drifted down and lingered on the white and pulsing handfuls of time, and beheld them with huge hunger to touch all the little milliseconds at once. "Wow, disrespectful," she once shouted when Stephen Crane burst into her house and grabbed a fistful of her and then dropped dead. Too young to hold so much heart-stopping boob of existence in his hand. Tits roam the earth in search of a body, and they knock on Emily Dickinson's door. But we'll never know what they said to each other. And the sound of the knocker itself was so soft. The ideal tit would be so big that it would include everything else in it. And you would be part of it. And you would be surrounded by it. And it would be wet and nude and in a white bikini that was see-through enough to show you and leave nothing of you to the imagination, right down to the goosebumps you got in church. "Is it cold in here?" men shout to the boob that contains them. "Careful not to put my eye out with that thing," they shout to the boob that contains them just before the darkness closes over. There is felt to be a huge heartbeat just beyond them. On her deathbed, Emily Dickinson whispered, "Destroy the negatives of my tit pics, the ones where they look like moon rocks, or else people will think I was from outer space." Her ideas are often spoken of as being out to here, accompanied by an exaggerated juggy motion of the hands. The hands bounced up and down slowly to imply heaviness. Picture her hidden breast, and a shocking tan line on it, from even she knows not where, from a sun inside her dress. Who is not an atheist about Emily Dickinson's body, which is totally unbelievable? It is the number one beach body every year for the way the letters wash up on it. Walt Whitman is the number two beach body every year, because look at the way he snapped back into shape only months after giving birth to American poetry. In order to sing louder, pretend you are singing to someone across the room. In order to get bigger tits, pretend they are 5 minutes ahead of you into the future. Pretend that more than the rest of you, they move around the sun. "Mommy!" cried the men to the boobs of Emily Dickinson.
"Did someone say mommy?"
Walt Whitman shouted, kicking open the door of his body and running into the room of hers. "I am the dad here," Emily Dickinson said gracefully, rearranging the black and white curls of her beard.
"I'm the goddamn mom," Walt Whitman bellowed, detaching a dog from one of his breasts and hurling it into the crowd,
where it woofed tremendously among the sexists. They exactly exchanged their gazes. "Well, time to die," Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson said to each other, and they fell backwards at exactly the same moment, toppled at last by their tits, which stood upright with nipples like perfect pink erasers. Both of them naked, and arrayed in all the invisible words, like said, and just, and oh, which are there but the reader never sees them. above them floating their titpicks, and floating above their titpicks, our eyes. I think that we're going to do a Q&A, so if anyone has questions. I think there's a guy with a microphone who can run around and do it.
When will you cash in with your big memoir?
Oh, that's in 2016. That's coming out from Riverhead in 2016. I've written some of it. I have not written all of it. Some of it is about cum, and some of it is about really serious stuff like religion. So I think it's going to really hit the things, like something for everyone, like touch all the bases. So, yeah. But look for it in 2016, and I will also be going on tour for that. Or wait, was that like a facetious question? Like, what? Are you writing a memoir, bitch? Like, yes, I am. Like, yeah, it's coming out.
You have such a powerful voice. What inspires your writing?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, obviously, if my brain was put together correctly, I would have like some sort of a job where I actually had to leave the house in the morning. But you find that if you're locked in a room all day, staring at a white wall, you can really be inspired by anything. So I would say solitude, forgetting to eat all the time, constantly until about 4 o'clock p.m. That's huge. And then also, I'm a very close reader. So half the day I'm just reading books and I'm just writing down whatever jumps out at me. Inspirationally speaking, though, I'm a person who thinks in terms of sound. So I'm walking around already with rhythms in place. And what happens generally is that from time to time, some sequence of words will flock to that rhythm and fit itself to it. And that's a line of poetry. And then you wait for the next one to come, and that's another line. Inspiration is not a super easy thing to quantify. It's difficult to talk about. You feel it when it happens. It feels like a bolt of lightning that goes straight through you and writes itself on the ground. It's a physical feeling. It's almost a feeling of athleticism. I watch a lot of movies, I read a lot of books, and I spend a lot of time alone. My favorite movie? Okay, so there are two movies that I watch the most, besides The Room, which is obviously the movie. I mean, out of all the movies, I've seen that one the most. Probably Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, weirdly. I just can always watch that. And then that documentary about Norwegian black metal, Until the Light Takes Us. I swear to God, like, I have seen that movie 100 freaking times because I'm obsessed with Fenris. Like, I don't know if I'm the only one. I'm completely, he's the lock screen on my phone. So, yeah, those would be my two. You can see the similarities. You know, I just love music so much. Any other questions? Oh, it's really tough, actually. Like, I thought that I would be able to do both things at the same time. I thought that I would be able to write a poem over here and then write, you know, serious or comic prose over here, and I can't. It turns out that I totally am unable to switch gears, like, at all. So for about the last year and a half, I've mostly just been writing the prose. So all of those like lyrical ideas that would typically go in poetry have gone into prose instead. It's really interesting because obviously when you're writing a book that's going to be, you know, 75,000 words, there's a lot more room, you know? There's like, if you actually went through my poetry books and tallied how many words were in them, it's like 400 words, you guys, for the entire book. So it's a feeling of expansiveness when you're writing prose that you don't have with poetry. You want to condense when you're writing poetry, and you want to sort of expand yourself when you're writing prose. So I'm reacting to inspiration in the same way, but I'm funneling it into just a slightly different form.
You were saying you like music?
Well, it was a joke. I actually...
Oh, really?
You don't like...
You music. Hate music?
I hate music.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, that's not true. You can ask me about music.
Okay, now what do you really, you hate or like
I love it. I love it and I hate it. It's a love-hate relationship that I have with music.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who do you like the most?
Musically.
What type of music do you like?
You know, this is sort of a weird answer, but I listen to a lot of opera. It's weird. I trained for a long time. Oh, yeah? You're an opera guy up here? Interesting. I trained for a while as an opera singer, and I was really, really bad because my sister was really good, and my parents thought if we get her lessons, we should also give Trisha lessons or she'll, like, freak out and, you know, become insane. But all that happened was I just had to go and, like, hear myself sounding horrible at those lessons for, like, an hour every week. But that didn't mean that I didn't actually love opera. So I listen to a lot more classical and opera than you would expect. I mean, I listen to a lot of the blues as well. I tend to go for music where the voice is primary. So I listen to a lot of the old torch singers, things like that. Like, some voices are extremely textual. They give you a lot to think about. I mean, you can think a lot about Maria Callas's voice in a way that you can't think about other people's, or Billie Holiday or something like that. There's this tremendous elasticity to them that helps you think. You know the kinds of art that make ideas apparent, because ideas are in the air, right? And suddenly, there's something in the atmosphere that changes, something visual or something to do with sound, and suddenly the ideas jump out with clarity that you don't see before. So you find those things and you try to surround yourself with them. But I was just teasing you. I don't hate music.
Hi.
Hello.
So earlier today, just because I'm a masochist, I decided to revisit the argument with Tosh and so on and so forth. Andrew Tosh, the wonderful comic who said some terrible things, and then as I reread your article.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about what's going on with microaggression towards women online and how it's becoming easier for us as women to collectively speak out against what was so easily dismissed as, like, oh, it's an isolated incident.
Right.
It's just you. Do you think for the younger generation of women, is it going to eventually, are we going to have a fourth wave of feminists?
I think we have it now. I mean, yeah. I think we're in the fourth wave. I think we're in, like, the sixth wave. I don't even know. Like, wave-wise, I'm not sure exactly where we are. But there are a couple things about the internet that are interesting. And the first is that it makes all that shit really visible. You see it. But, you know, if you say something to me in a room, like you talk about microaggressions, if that happens, if I'm at my job or something and some dude says something to me, he's the only other one who sees it. But on the internet, everyone can see that. You can actually point to these things. There's accumulation, there's aggregation. You can show people that this is what's going on. And I think it's made it a lot easier, too, for women to actually band together and speak up for each other. Because I know I've gotten, obviously, I get weird shit on the internet. Not as much as a lot of women. But I do get a lot of weird stuff. I get weird reviews. I get, you know, weird patronizing comments from time to time. But what can happen now is that you have, like, a club. You can have a posse now, and women can defend each other as long as, you know, we can recognize that we need to do that. And I think that we do. And so, to me, when those things happen, the initial sort of feeling in the pit of your stomach that you get when that kind of thing happens is outweighed by the sort of warmth that you feel when people actually come to your aid. I do think it's changing. I do.
At a certain point, as a writer that had not yet, I guess, broken out or something, I don't really know how to describe, but was there ever a point in which, like, a shift happened where, or did you ever feel like what you had to say maybe wasn't worth saying, or who was going to listen, and how did you conquer that, if not, if you
didn't? I never had that because I'm a psychopath, and I think that. Like, I hear, because I do hear a lot of women talk about this, and I do think it's obviously a problem. Like, there's something about the way we're talking to young girls and to women that's making them feel like, why should anyone listen to me? Why should I get to do this? Why should I be a writer? I have some insane other problem where I'm like, yeah, you should listen to me. Like, you should listen to me all the time. You should constantly listen to everything I'm saying. which is not good either. But it's probably, you know, better to err in that direction when it comes to that kind of thing. It's your birthright. I mean, it is. You get this language. You get this body. You get this brain. You get to choose what you do with it. It is your birthright. That is for you. So recognize that, claim it, and then just put your eyes on the horizon and just don't let people distract you. And don't let that little voice, which I assume is what people are hearing, you know, telling them, like, why is this worthwhile? Why should I listen to you? You can't listen to that. That's crazy. You have to be a psycho about it. That's my advice.
Was there any one person that was a big inspiration for you to become a writer?
This is so interesting because every time I get asked this question, I completely blank. And I feel like, you know, the only books I've ever read in my life are the Clan of the Cave Bear books, which, I mean, I love them, but they're not my primary influence. But, you know, when I was a kid, my reading was limited because it was sort of like a religious household. So I read a lot of the Bible. I was reading like Augustine, you know, it was really ridiculous. It was one of those sort of upbringings. And I only had access, I would say, the most modern poetry that I had access to was the modernists. So I was reading like T.S. Eliot, I was reading Wallace Stevens. It was honestly a bunch of white guys. I don't even think I got to read, you know, people like Elizabeth Bishop and Mary Ann until much later. So for me, I think that Wallace Stevens was probably a primary influence. His form and his symmetry and his use of the tautology were very important. But then later, I came to people like Kenneth Koch of the New York School, and I thought, you know, you can do that kind of thing with a much lighter voice. Because there can be almost a ponderous quality to modernism where you're like a little crab scuttling on the floor of the sea and you're like, can't decide whether you want to eat a peach or not. Just shut the fuck up. Like, eat a peach, man. Like, live your life. So I thought, all right, we can preserve that form, but we can maybe pour a different voice into it. That was sort of what I figured out. But yeah, honestly, what I need to do is I need to write a list of people that I have read the works of, because I get to this point, I'm like, I don't know how to read. In my life, I feel like I've already achieved all of them. No, and this is the other good thing about me. I have no sense of time or of the future. I'm like one of those people who's floating in a sensory deprivation tank who just has no idea and has having waking nightmares constantly because they don't know whether they're awake or asleep. What day of the week is it? I don't know. I have no idea. What month is it? Like, I don't know. So, you don't think a whole lot about the future when you're that kind of idiot. So that helps me, because that means that I'm just working on the things that I'm working on at that moment. And then when good things happen because of the things I've worked on, it seems like a big surprise. So that's cool. It's kind of a cool way to be, I feel. It might also be insane. I'm not sure.
The title of your new book of poetry,
yeah.
Is it some spin-off like how Europe was like fatherland, motherland, and now we have this whole homeland security.
Yeah. It's just sort of doing all that.
Is there any hidden meanings behind that, or?
No, I wish that I were putting hidden meanings in everything. I really do. I also wish that there were like subliminal messages that I was putting in, but I'm not. It turns out that mostly what I was doing with this title was writing something that everyone would get wrong constantly. I was introduced at one reading and they were like, and now the author of Motherland, Fatherland, Homosexuals, and I'm like, that would be just a much different title than the one that I was actually using. So they never seem complicated to me, but yeah, it was calling into question the uses of all those terms. Like, homeland is a really weird, fatherland, motherland, and it's all for the same thing, you know. And then there's just a pure element too of sound with homeland sexual. Because it sounds enough like homosexual that people actually think that the title of my book is Motherland, Fatherland, Homosexual. So, like, what are you going to do? That's my bad. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you guys for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org /author events.